listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. On this Monday night, greed is good. That's usually the mantra we most associate with working on Wall Street. Carrie Sun had a chance to see if that was indeed the case, spending 2 years as a personal assistant to the billionaire founder of one of America's most secretive and successful hedge funds. She takes us behind the curtains in her book, Private Equity, a Memoir, and is with me to tell us all about it. What does your personal space look like, your bubble? What's comfortable for you? How much has it changed since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic? And how do Canadians compare with others around the world? New research puts some science behind the whole idea of your personal space, and we'll dig into that. But first, from These Eyes to Undone to American Woman, Stand Tall, You Saved My Soul, Burton Cummings is one of Canada's most successful and enduring singers and songwriters. He celebrates 60 years in the music business this year with a new album out soon and a North American tour on tap. He joins me to talk about getting his start in Winnipeg in the early 60s, how some of his biggest hits came about, and much more. It's my great pleasure to welcome one of the biggest names in Canadian music and who has been for decades now. Burton Cummings is celebrating 60 years in the business this year, born on December 31st, 1947. It all began in Winnipeg in the early 60s. Do the math. He was still a very young man. You may remember this one. She's my lover. I want her back again. She's my lover. Love just seems to know when. She's my lover. I want her back again. That should be the Deverones. She's Your Lover, written by Burton Cummings. You can actually see his name on that very old 45. It's a great to look it up on YouTube. It's a fantastic find. And that would lead to another famous launching pad, Chad Allen and the Expressions a few years later. The rest, as you may say, in this country and worldwide is music history, as Cummings soon became the lead singer after Chad Allen left the band, and a publicity stunt had already landed the name The Guess Who, put it out there, and their first album under that name, It's Time, was released in the summer of 1966, including this one. Look at the way they walk down the street. You can see she's his girl. All of the guys I know envy him when they've seen his girl. Remarkable how good it still sounds, isn't it? All the way back in 1966 from Winnipeg. Within 4 years, teaming up with Randy Bachman, the band would become the first Canadian band to score a number one hit in the U.S. with American Woman, of course. And there are many, many other milestones and stories to tell from there. Cummings continues to record and tour. He has a new album coming out. He's going on the road this year to celebrate those 60 years, including many dates here in Canada that we'll talk about, and several in the U.S. as well. He's playing that series of concerts. He's also going to be at the Gordon Lightfoot tribute coming up at Massey Hall. There are reissues of two of his solo albums, including Sweet Sweet, and he's marking this remarkable musical milestone by talking to me tonight. Burton Cummings, it's a great joy. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It was remarkable. I was watching some interviews that you'd done about sort of finding your way musically in Winnipeg in the early 60s and how later that decade there were programs where you could kind of learn how to do this. But when you set out, this was uncharted territory.
Well, we were lucky in Winnipeg. There were three AM radio stations all competing for the audience. And actually, one of them, CKY, was 50,000 watts clear channel. So on cold nights, it was going out really for hundreds of miles, I guess. We were lucky, and especially Randy Bachman and myself, because we were the songwriters, and we were lucky in the fact that we heard so many different kinds and styles of music on those three stations in Winnipeg. It was definitely the best place to be in Canada to learn about music. Absolutely, no question about it.
It was amazing listening back to some of your very first records these days, because you can hear you, even in the early 60s, you could hear your voice, like you could see where it's going.
Well, I didn't know where it was going. I was a kid with a lot of big dreams, and I was in the right place at the right time, and I had always wanted to be a songwriter, but I had never really had the opportunity to make many records. That one you played, She's My Lover, that was 1965, I think. And that's probably the flip side of the first record I ever made. But we had recorded a little bit before that, the Devrons. That was my first band, the Devrons. But it was just hard. Winnipeg was remote, and it was hard to get. It wasn't like living in New York or San Francisco or Chicago or Los Angeles, where you could go to a recording session, or there were record companies. There really wasn't any of that in Winnipeg. So we were kind of living a dream,
It's remarkable also just when you talk about the influences that you had back then, that you were, because you see it in the styles of the music. It changes quite rapidly over the 60s for you, just in your songwriting style. And of course, when you meet Randy, it all sounds so easy, but I'm sure it wasn't.
Well, there was a program on Sunday morning on CKY Radio, Radio 58, and we used to get up to listen to it. It was called Hits Around the World. Hello, it's Sunday morning with Dino Corey, and here are Hits Around the World. And Dennis Corey would play songs by Cliff Richard and the Shadows, and the Shadows that we hadn't heard, Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, a lot of stuff from England, a lot of stuff from Australia. And I don't think the other people in Canada were hearing these things the way we were in Winnipeg. We used to get up in the morning and listen to that show on Sunday morning, very excited to hear what was coming from England next,
Yeah, because you can hear the influences. So Chad Allen and the Expressions, you leave the Devrons, you join that band. Within a fairly short period of time, you're front and center. And I don't think you're 18. If you're 18, you're just 18.
I had just turned 18 in December, and I did my first show in public with I can't remember what month it was, but yeah, they called me when I was still 17. I hadn't even turned 18 yet.
Unbelievable. What was that like? I mean, how quickly did it click between you and Randy? And because within a few years, some of your most famous songs are being written. How quickly did it click between the two of you?
Well, he was already, I looked up to him as a songwriter already because he had a couple of records on the radio with songs that he had written. But he liked the way I wrote lyrics. I was more of a lyric guy, and he was more of a hook, instrumental hook guy. So the two of us worked well together. I think we fed off each other fairly well.
Yeah, there's an interesting line you have about sort of finessing his lyrics that I thought was pretty funny.
Well, I mean, I've been sarcastic through the years in different interviews, and we always weren't the best of friends, so I may have said some sarcastic stuff. But overall, I think we both benefited from working with each other. I really do.
Yeah. I mean, I think even when it came out with genuine affection, to be frank. Like it sounded like you had a lot of respect for your ability. I think it was to sort of squish each other's stuff and come out with the best possible version of a song.
And we used to come to each other with pieces, and that was a great way to write because you'd see what the other guy, which direction the other guy would take it, and it was kind of exciting to see where it was going to go next.
You gave a nice shout out to local TV at one point. I think at one point you were playing on a CBC show, I think it was called Let's Go, that gave you some exposure. So you were kind of learning as you went, but you were getting some good opportunities to showcase what you were doing as well.
Well, it was a big, it was a bit of a Cinderella story. The producer of the TV show, we were doing weekly television every Thursday at 5:30 after school. We were in everybody's living room for half an hour every Thursday for 2 years. And our producer, Larry Brown, he knew that Randy and I were starting to write songs. So he said, look, you've got a national audience here on television. Why don't you do a couple of your original songs? I'm all for that. The producer was encouraging us. So one of the songs we picked to do was These Eyes. And that particular Thursday in Toronto, Jack Richardson, who ended up producing all the Guess Who records, he happened to be watching the show, and he believed so strongly in the song that he ended up taking us to New York to record our first album with RCA.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. It's a Cinderella story.
If
Jack Richardson hadn't been watching that show that day, these eyes might not have happened, you know, and that's the song that changed our lives.
It's my great pleasure to have Burton Cummings, one of the great Canadian music legends, with us. He's celebrating 60 years in the music business this year. He's heading out on tour. He has a new album coming out. Burton, I was reading that you and Randy wrote that song at your mom's place.
Yeah, that's how long ago it was. I hadn't even left home yet. I was still living at home in the north end of Winnipeg with my mother and grandmother. And Randy came over one Saturday morning and brought an acoustic guitar. And we sat at my mom's piano and put it all together. He had some pieces, you know, and I had some pieces. And by the time it was finished, it was a pretty good song.
No kidding. And, half an hour.
And that same process occurred during the following few years, too, because, you know, he and I found it easy to come to each other with pieces. We would come to each other with unfinished songs, and 9 times out of 10, the other guy would finish it. So it was kind of nice. It was exciting.
Yeah. I was it called These Arms originally? I read that somewhere.
He wanted to call it These Arms, and I didn't like that as much as These Eyes. Why, I don't know, but I think it ended up the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, it was funny. You also, I think at the time, because it's a very heart-wrenching song, and yet you've spoken over time that at the time you didn't really know much about heartbreak. It just came out that way.
No, it was hypothetical. We weren't writing about somebody's broken heart and some terrible piece of emotional disaster. We weren't writing about that at all. It was all hypothetical. You know, we were just trying to, we loved the songwriters. Besides the British invasion guys like Lennon and McCartney and Jagger and Richard, we liked, you know, Doc Pomus and Mort Schumann. We liked Burt Bacharach and Hal David. We liked Carole King and Jerry Goffin. We liked the songwriting teams, the legendary songwriting teams. And you know, so that's Randy and I kind of, we kind of fantasized that we could be a songwriting team.
Yeah. And then Jack Richardson, who you already mentioned, who produced the album, I think he mortgaged his house, did he not? He believed in that song and you so much?
There's a bit of that sounds a bit like a fairy tale. I'm not sure, but it seems that it's true. I've heard it said by enough people at different stages of time that he went and got a mortgage on the house to be able to take us all to New York and pay for the recording sessions and then go and sell the album after that to a label. Because when we went to New York, we weren't signed yet to RCA. Jack believed in us enough, and he heard some other songs that Randy and I had written, and he believed in all of that enough to take us to New York without a signed contract. And then once the things were finished, it was easier for him to sell us to a label, and RCA were the ones that signed us.
One of the stories I love the most about that song is we'll listen to a short snippet of this, because Junior Walker and the All-Stars, Shotgun's an amazing song. Within months of your record coming out in America, he's done a version. Let's have a quick listen. Yeah, that must have been such a thrill. I think you met him afterwards, right? You played with him.
We did a show, the Guess Who and Gary Puckett and the Union Gap and Junior Walker and the All-Stars. And I think it was in Boston, actually, way, way back. And Randy and I took the chance to go to Junior Walker's bus and give him a big hug and a big high five and thanks, man. It's nice to meet you. We love the fact that you recorded our song. I mean, a couple of young white guys from the north end of Winnipeg and one of the biggest Motown stars in history records your song and it becomes a hit record for him. We were stoked, man. We were over the moon about that.
Yeah. And must have given you, I mean, you were, that song really changed kind of, it feels like it changed the trajectory going forward because all of a sudden you were a band in America that people, and in Canada, obviously, that people recognized. People started to wait for your next records.
Well, I mean, we got very lucky and RCA, at that time, RCA was a pretty powerful label. They had Elvis Presley, they had Hall & Oates, they had all kind of the Friends of Distinction. So Harry Nilsson was on RCA too. So it was kind of a happening label at the time. And we got a fair share of promotion from RCA.
Yeah. I want to play you a clip because the song still resonates today. We'll listen to a clip from Superbad. This is Michael Cera.
These eyes cry every night for you. These arms they long to hold you again.
I'll be honest, Bert, that sounds like most of the versions of your song that I've heard at karaoke, but what a compliment to have it resonate.
That was quite a thrill. I'm glad that was used in the movie. It was great. Made me smile, tell you that.
Great to have Burton Cummings here celebrating 60 years in the music business. We've had some texts come in, Derek in Edmonton, saying, if you get this, please tell Burton he's amazing. And I love his music. There you have it. Burton Cummings, amazing to listen to American Woman today because it still sounds fine. It's great.
Well, I'll tell you, though, vocally, I never quite nailed it the way I wanted to. I mean,
really?
It was 1969, 1970, and everybody, I mean, a lot of singers wanted to be Robert Plant, and that's what I was going for, and it still sounds a bit weak to me, although it became a very big record, so I'm not arguing with the success of the record. I'm only pointing out that I never felt that I quite nailed the vocal, but the record obviously had something because it was 3 weeks at number one in Billboard, and no one in Canada had ever done that.
No, I remember hearing it for the first time, I think, when they did the Best of the 70s in 1979, and it was still in the top, I think it was in the top 50 for the entire decade. It was that huge.
Yeah. Well, it was a very big record, and it was timing as well. It was never meant to be political, but it came out at a point in 1970 when the Vietnam War was escalating terribly, and there were thousands of American soldiers over there, and they loved the record because they read their own inferences into the record. It was never meant to be political. We had toured the States, and to me it occurred that the girls wanted to grow up faster in the States. They wore more makeup and dressed more adult at a younger age. And then we came back to Canada, and we were touring Canada again, and I looked out at the crowd, and it didn't seem to me that the girls were growing up quite as fast in Canada. So what I was thinking in my head was, Canadian woman, I prefer you. And what came out of my mouth on stage was, American woman, stay away from me. It was never meant to be political, but all those things factored together, it created a number one record.
It did, yeah. I mean, was it a riff? Is there a story that I heard where Randy was playing that famous riff off the top and you sort of came in and just kind of started to riff off that?
Well, we were doing two shows then, and between shows, I was outside bartering with some guy for some old Gene Vincent records. I'm still a very avid record collector. And then suddenly I hear the band on stage. Randy had started this riff up. I said to this guy, oh, my gosh, man, I'm supposed to be on stage. I got to get inside. So I run inside, and they've got the groove going already. Randy had the groove going. and it's just da 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 da. I just started making things up. I was trying to get things to rhyme at first, just trying to make things rhyme. Colored lights can hypnotize, sparkle someone else's eyes. I don't need your war machines. I don't need your ghetto scenes. All that stuff flowed out like a Bob Dylan stream of consciousness moment. You know, I don't know where those things come from, but I'm certainly glad they did that night.
Yeah. It's interesting you talk, because your voice, I mean, if you listen to like Undone or Laughing or These Eyes, and then you listen to American Woman, you can see that you're kind of playing around with what you can do, right? And that must be a really interesting, especially when you're already successful, it must be interesting to sort of push boundaries like that and see if you like what you hear.
Well, I was a lead singer from day one. In the first band, they were an instrumental band, and I weaseled my way into the Devrons by hanging around their practices enough and saying things like, "You guys ever think of getting a singer? Hey, you guys could sure use a singer. Hey, I could show you this, and I could show you that." And what happened was, before we had hit records of our own, I was a cover band guy who sang all the songs on the hit parade month after month, year after year. So I was singing when we would do Manfred Mann, I would imitate Paul Jones. When we would do The Stones, I would imitate Mick Jagger. When we would do Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas, I would imitate Billy J. Kramer, et cetera, et cetera. And we'd do Marv, I would imitating singers like Marvin Gaye and Bobby V and all kinds of different singers. And I was imitating these singers, and it helped me develop whatever style I have.
Yeah. I mean, it's, tell me a bit, Texter just says American Woman is a powerhouse. Love Burton. So I guess people still love hearing it, right? I guess we're always our own worst critics, aren't we, sometimes, but about things like that. If you could have just changed it a little bit, you would have liked it even more.
Yeah, I would have, I would have worked a little harder on it, but I had no idea. I mean, those were the days we recorded very fast, you know, very quickly. So we didn't get a chance to think about it and live with it the way we do nowadays. I've been listening to the mixes of my new album for weeks now and humming and hawing and going over details. Back in those days, you bang things out and away you go. You know, we did our first album, We Feel Soul, I think within a week, within about 4 or 5 recording days, the whole thing was recorded and mixed. So there you go. Times have changed. Nowadays, we have computers doing a lot of the work.
Yeah, you know, I think you had 11 studio albums with the Guess Who. I mean, that was a lot of records in a short period of time. You're right. That was intense. It was an intense process, I can imagine.
Yeah, I think there was 1 year, might have been 72 or 73. There was 1 year we had three albums out in 1 year. And that's, boy, I'm telling you, man, that's, when you're doing that, you're on the treadmill. Believe me, you're on the treadmill.
Yeah. You played at the White House. This is a famous story. And I know you've probably been asked about this way too many times, but you get invited to play American Woman at the White House, right? Or for Richard Nixon's daughter. There's been a lot of stories about that one over the years.
Well, a lot of it is BS, completely BS.
No doubt.
I'll tell you the truth right now. We were never asked not to play American Woman. That was absolutely nonsense. That was BS. Our manager at the time had a brilliant idea, and I say that with all intent of sarcasm. He had the brilliant idea to say to the public that the Nixons had asked us not to play American Woman. That never happened. And what happened was, because the Nixons weren't that popular with the general American public at the time. Anyway, it all backfired on us. And, you know, it was a night I met Trisha Nixon and the David Eisenhower, I guess it was, and the prince and princess from England were there,
Oh, wow.
who is now the king. met him and his sister. It was a very upper echelon deal. And it was on the 4th of July, and it was on the White House lawn, you know, in the shadow of the big Washington Monument. It was pretty incredible. And, oh, I got to remember, here's something I always remember. It's not like it was before 9/11. When we went into the White House, man, there was no security. We weren't frisked. We weren't even asked to get out of the limo. They did a quick sweep of one thing of the vehicle underneath the carriage of the vehicle, and we were in. Today, you can't even get within a block of the White House without being scanned. And I remember the lack of security was amazing. But here's the thing, man. Terrorism hadn't progressed at that point. It was 1970, so it was long before a lot of the hijacking and the people driving passenger planes into skyscrapers. It was long before that.
Yeah, a different time. One of the things that came up, someone's texted in to ask about a song. This was actually the first song of yours that I heard. I was born in 1970, so I don't want to, I won't bring that in, but we always have our first memory of when we hear a band, right? So this was, Clap for the Wolfman was the first Guess Who song that I ever heard. Let's have a listen.
Clap for the Wolfman, he gonna reach your record high.
That was a massive hit, and one of our listeners wanted to know where the idea for it came from, because, again, it was huge. It was part of this huge string of hits that you had.
Well, let's see. That was 1974, I guess it was. 73 or 74 when we cut it anyway. The trucker thing with CB?
Right.
CB? CB, the CB trucking thing had just taken off. It was a craze at the time. It was a fad. And everybody had handles. What's your CB handle? Well, I'm Mr. North. Well, yeah. I'm Trucker John.
Right.
The boys, a couple of the other boys in the Guess Who, they wanted to write a song about that. And they wanted the guy CB to be Napoleon. So the song started off as Clap for Napoleon. Right. Well, I'm thinking to myself, you know, and I'm usually the lyric guy. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, the song is going to have to self-explain what Napoleon is and who he is and blah, blah, blah. In the meantime, we had been doing Midnight Special several times at this point in our lives. And I said, look, I love I love the guitar hook, and I like some of the music. I said, but let's make the song about the Wolfman. He's our friend now from Midnight Special. Let's make it about him. Everybody in the world knows who Wolfman Jack is. So the guy said, okay. So I came up with all these lyrics. And then initially, I was going to imitate the Wolfman between verses and say a couple of things. You know, I can't do the Wolfman, but it would have been pathetic. It wouldn't have been the same. So as it happens, here's another thing like American Woman, a Cinderella story. We're finishing up the record, and I'm ready to do my Wolfman imitation between verses. And who happens to be in Toronto where we're recording, emceeing a hot rod show, but Wolfman Jack himself? So... this was like sent to us on a platter. We got a hold of him and we said, look, we've got a song about you. Would you come and be on it? His initial reaction was, now, didn't want anything to do with it. Didn't want to have a damn thing to do with it. We phoned him back again the next day and said, look, can we just come to your hotel and play you a bit of the song and see what you think? And then you can tell us to go to hell if you want. He said, all right. So we we go over. We take a little cassette machine with us. We play him the song. We're into the song maybe 30 seconds total. And he said, when do you want me in the studio? He loved it. The minute he heard it, he loved it. But he didn't like the idea of it until he had heard it.
And the rest is musical history, right? It's probably one of the most, for people who didn't know him afterwards, it lives on. His legacy lives on through it in some ways as well.
Well, he just, you know, he said, well, what do you want me to say? What do you want me to say? I said, look, just ad lib, just, I think I told him, just be the Wolfman. I said, you know, what more can I say? Put it as simply as possible. Just be the Wolfman. And he did. And it worked out perfectly. And you know what? It didn't hurt his career either. He started going emceeing more and more shows. He came and emceed some of the Guess Who shows. We did a big show in Honolulu, in the Hawaiian Honolulu International Center, the big arena in Honolulu. Aerosmith, the Guess Who, and Wolfman Jack emceed the show. And I have this vivid memory of Steven Tyler, because Steven Tyler's not that tall a guy. And I have vivid memory of Steven Tyler running around backstage. Where's the Wolfman? Where's the Wolfman? I want to see the Wolfman. Where's the Wolfman? It's great.
It's great to have Burton Cummings with us this hour, talking about his 60 years in music, his upcoming tour. Burton, I know you have some re-releases coming out of some of your original records, including Sweet Sweet. That song is from Sweet Sweet, You Saved My Soul. That must be nice to be able to put music back out there with new liner notes and new stories and so on.
Well, we have Plus Signs as well coming back out. We have Sweet Sweet and Plus Signs right now. And there will be Heart as well, which a lot of people have been clamoring for. We finally found the masters from all of this.
Great.
So, you know.
Might as well put it out. And you have a new record coming out. You just mentioned earlier that you've been working on the mixes and so on.
We just finished going through the final processes now of endlessly listening to the mixes, deciding what's absolutely carved in stone and finished. Very happy with the songs. I mean, I'm getting to the age now where I can't afford to put out something that's going to embarrass me in 3 or 4 years. So I'm very happy with this. We worked very hard on it. They're all original songs. Some I've written myself, some I've co-written, but they're all original songs, except one. There's a cover song by a band called Archangels. Other than that, they're all original songs. And I think they're some of my strongest songs in years. But that's for me to think right now. We'll see what happens when we release it.
Yeah, and that's coming up pretty soon, I gather.
Two or three months.
We'll be on the lookout for sure. And you're heading out on tour. I mean, it's the 60th anniversary tour. I know that Casino Rama so far, I think there's a date coming up in July in Kempville as well. And you're doing the big Massey Hall concert for Gordon Lightfoot. But I'm sure you're going to add others, and you're going to the States as well.
Yeah, we're going back to the States and then back again across Canada. I've got the same band that I've had for years. It's a very, very tight band. It's a pretty good 2-hour show. All hit records. I mean, we have a lot of hit records to play, so people enjoy. We usually send the crowds home happy. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I mean, it must be hard to curate a whole show these days because you have so many songs that people would want to hear. People were just texting me about, you know, Midnight Special. There's all these things that people bring up that are songs that they're big fans of from over the years, right?
Well, I'm blessed to have had those songs that one of the things that I've been so lucky, the songs have never gone away. I still hear the songs that I sang and wrote, you know, all the Guess Who stuff that I sang and wrote. I hear it all the time. I hear it all the time on the radio. So it's nice to have had that trickle down effect so that the songs have been on the radio for years now. Not everybody is lucky enough to be on the radio for over 50 years.
No, not at all. Well, Burton Cummings, listen, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing the hour with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and thanks for all the kind words. My goodness, my hat size is going up from all the compliments. So thank you very much, Ben. It was tremendous.
Homelessness in this country, the plight of those who are unhoused in this country has been talked about a lot. It's been a really tough winter. There's been, you know, the sort of taking down of homeless encampments and so on. There's been shelter space or lack of shelter space. It's become, you know, it continues to be a big issue in Canada. And so what better time for Global News in Edmonton to track the lives of four unhoused people in Edmonton over the course of a year, from the coldest winter night, as they put it, to the smokiest summer day. It's called Surviving Edmonton, and it's a oftentimes these stories about homelessness tend to sort of focus on the stats and what could be done and what government is doing. This is a personal look on what it's like to actually be out there, how you wound up there, how you're trying to get out, what life is like day in, day out. I mean, Edmonton, of course, one of Canada's coldest cities. So Global News spent time inside drop-in shelters, encampments during extreme cold warnings, inside supportive housing facilities, and they got a firsthand account of what it's like to be on the streets in Edmonton. They spoke to, again, one of them is a couple. This is Troy Cardinal and Leanne Watney.
Last year in the wintertime, we almost froze on White Ave. We had two blankets each and we were on a bench.
Yeah, my hands blistered up. I lost feeling in my hands and my feet.
Still?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Been trying to keep us safe and alive.
That was Troy Cardinal and Leanne Watney, two of the four people featured in Surviving Edmonton. Morgan Black for Global Edmonton premiered the piece tonight. Again, it's about those who are unsheltered who find themselves on the streets of Edmonton. And it's something that doesn't just apply to Edmonton, by the way. I think if you listen to the stories and how they're told, this could be any city in the country. Perhaps Edmonton faces its own challenges just because of how brutally cold it can be. But a lot of the way people wind up unhoused, some of the challenges they face while they're out there, some of the problems with the shelter system are not true only in Edmonton. They're universally true in this country. And Morgan Black joins me now. Morgan, thanks for your time tonight. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, what was it? I mean, when you set out for this idea, I think it's one of those ideas people have, and it's sometimes hard to find the right people to tell the story, allow them or have them allow you into their lives that way, and then sort of chart a full year of doing this. It must have been an incredible experience.
That is a wonderful way to describe it. It was absolutely incredible. And you know, it was the idea was kind of conceptualized by a very simplistic moment. We had a separate crew go out, and they were just doing, you know, a generic story on housing, and they were speaking with a lady who was living in an encampment. And before she did her interview, she said, okay, wait, I just got to go do my makeup. And so she went inside, she did her makeup, she went inside her tent, came back out and did her interview. And I think that oftentimes people without homes are a very dehumanized group across Canada. And that moment was so human that she just wanted to look good when she did her on-camera interview. And the crew, they brought that story back to us. And our assignment editor said, wouldn't it be something if we found some folks that we could just follow for a year and just kind of get to know them and get to know not just, you know, their struggle, but their joy and their grief and their hardships and everything in the middle. And that's how Surviving Edmonton was born.
Right. And then going out and being able to earn that trust as well from different people, to be able to share their stories over that period of time. That must have been interesting as well, because it really does give you a lot more insight just into how their lives evolved over 12 months.
Totally. And we had connected with, I've been doing some stories kind of in that realm of housing supports earlier. And so I had a few contacts in the community and I said, do you know anyone that might be a good fit for this? Because obviously there's a lot of challenges with no fixed address, no phones. It's difficult to keep track of folks and get in touch with them. So we kind of had to start at this baseline of some level of being able to stay in touch with them, right? Or they have their routines. And so, you know, you could always find someone at X shelter or Y shelter. So we had reached out to some housing folks, somebody who was, you know, in the shelter system, somebody who was a housing advocate, and they connected us with Kimberly, Troy, and Leanne, and Adam. Those are the four folks that we met in our story. And it was difficult still to keep track of these folks. The longest I lost someone was 5 months before we could track them down again. But we find our way back, and you know, losing track of them is also part of the story, because it's why did they go dark? Like, what happened in that time period that also is explored?
Yeah. Yeah, we played that clip of one of your interviews with Troy and Leanne, which of course is a reminder. I think a lot of us were talking about, I think we actually did an interview this winter on the situation in Edmonton, because there were some issues around the clearing of homeless encampments, about there not being enough shelter space, about people not wanting to go to shelters, period. And that clip from Troy and Leanne was a reminder of just how incredibly difficult life on the streets can be in any part of Canada in the winter, but Edmonton has its own challenges in itself.
Yeah, and when our crew, and it was a small crew, it was just myself, and then we kind of switched between four or so videographers. When we went out one night, it was the coldest night of the year in January, minus 30, even colder with the wind chill. And we were meeting folks who were in various, you know, some people were staying in encampments, some people were staying just on the street, and then some people were trying to get into shelter. And I think about it so much that night, because that was the night where everyone was being told, don't be outside for more than 5 minutes. Like, that's when the frostbite hits. That's when you lose feeling. That's when you have some serious health impacts. And it was just all of these folks, you know, some people were wearing runners, no mittens, a light windbreaker. Like, that's your protection out there. And so we spent that time chatting with a lot of different people, not just the central characters of our story, but those were the nights where we really branched out and got that community feel. I mean, Edmonton, as you said, experiences a lot of extreme weather. We have, you know, a lot of smoke, a lot of heat in the summer, which presents different challenges, but it's that minus 30 where you really just do wonder, how are people surviving out there? And this special kind of goes there, right, where that question is.
Yeah, it was interesting that Troy and Leanne, of course, have each other.
They had such a striking love story, and I didn't expect to find a love story in this, because there is so much hardship and so much difficulty. But that was what made everything worth it for them, and that was their main motivation, right? Was that Troy just wanted Leanne to be safe, and he is and continues to be. He's just willing to do whatever it is, and he's letting her sleep on top of him so that she doesn't freeze in the middle of the night. And he's, you know, he's giving his sandwich to her because he knows she's hungry, and he's looking after her when they've walked 10 kilometers and they can't go any further. And so he sets her up for that success, and she in return is just like this huge emotional rock for him. And that was another really striking thing, is I did not expect to also be telling a love story kind of in the middle of all of this. That was the first thing I noticed about them. I was like, this cannot be a story if it's not about how much they love each other.
Yeah. And also one of the reasons that they don't like going to shelters is because they'd be separated. But also they talk quite openly about their drug use as well, and watching people, acquaintances and people they know, die on the streets as well. I mean, it was a very harrowing interview. I mean, their relationship and their existence, I was very harrowing to watch.
Yeah, they have. And, you know, they're such a perfect symbol of why going from unhoused to housed is so complicated, because they told me they'd like nothing more than to get into an apartment and just be together and kind of move on with their lives together, as, you know, traditionally you would see couples do. But they have all of these barriers in front of them, and some of them are things that I'm not even quite sure they'd be willing to give up, right? Like they're using drugs, but they're also seeing drug poisonings happen on the streets of Edmonton. They're trying to save people from drug poisonings, but they also are part of that themselves. And so they're also looking out for each other in that way too. And yeah, it just, I already knew that the stories would probably be pretty complicated, you know, when we're looking at the concept of housing. And then once I got into it, it was even more complicated than that, which I thought was really striking. And it was very humanizing. Everything was.
I couldn't do tents, like I keep saying, because the dangers of it all. Violence happens. It's easily burnt. They've had propane tanks blow up on them in a tent.
That was Kimberly Robertson, one of the four people that Morgan Black, a Global Edmonton reporter, followed over the course of a year for a special that aired tonight called Surviving Edmonton. You can find it on YouTube. It's out there now if you'd like to watch it, no matter where you're listening tonight. And Morgan is with us this half hour. Morgan, that was an interesting one, because Kimberly's journey to unhoused was very different from some of the others you'd spoken to, well, specifically Troy and Leanne.
Yeah, Kimberly we spent the most time with, because she was the most easy to track down. And I wonder if that was kind of indicative of her journey as well, because she was the farthest along the path to stable housing. And so we met her. She was mostly using the shelter system. You heard that in her clip earlier. She talks about how she is very much opposed to living in an encampment. She finds it dangerous. She talks about the violence the tent fires, the things like that. So we met her in January 2023. Her focus was getting housed, you know, and things progress along. There are a lot of twists and turns in her journey, but eventually she does end up in a housing situation. And that was a really interesting experience for me, because when I heard that and we set up our next interview, I thought I was walking into a happy ending. And mm-hmm. and that really opened my eyes, that what I thought was Kimberly's happy ending was not quite what she saw out of it. And it really struck me that again, as we discussed, the complicated factors to being unhoused and going to housed, it took me by surprise, because what I thought was a success, she didn't perceive quite the same way. And that is explored in the feature as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is such, that's why doing the kind of work you did is so interesting and so important, because it is complicated. We tend to talk about the homeless or the unhoused, and yet, as you pointed out, every one of their stories is I wouldn't call them radically different, but they're significantly different, and the barriers they face and the challenges they face and what they ultimately, what success ultimately looks like for them is all very different. You must have walked away thinking, I don't know if you walked away with more questions than answers, but certainly you walked away with a lot of questions, obviously.
Certainly did. And I also found when it was time to contextualize this into the 30-minute piece, I was grappling with how much I had learned and how much I had changed over my expectations of what the year would bring, and then to kind of pare that down into something that, you know, I lived this year alongside Kimberly, Troy, Leanne, and Adam, and then I really found it a daunting task to present that to folks who never met them, right, and help people to understand why so many things were just not as easy for them as it would be for us, right? It's like, okay, well, you know, you're in a shelter. Doesn't that work for you? And they say no. And then you ask, well, why not? You have housing, you have food. What else is missing? And then they would explain these really, like, you know, multi-layered answers. And sometimes it was simply just that they felt better living the other way. And that was really, you know, it was hard to grapple with, because I had to really keep an open mind about a lot of these different scenarios, because it really just pointed out to me again, it's that what works for someone doesn't work for someone else. And this path from unhoused to housed is not, it's not as easy as just, you know, here's a space to live.
Yeah. What are some of the misconceptions that you faced over the year that you walked away with thinking differently about?
Well, I would say for sure it was that if you have shelter, that must be a success story. And you know, in many ways it is. But when you think of it as, like, for instance, when Kimberly is in her supportive housing unit, she kind of brings up this fact that she feels a little bit like a teenager living with her parents, or she feels like mm-hmm. she's got a lot of rules to follow. And when I went there, you know, it was wonderful to see her in this space where she can, you know, keep her clothes and kind of draw and devote time to her passions instead of just trying to find somewhere to be safe for every waking moment. But I was kind of like, oh, okay, I do see what you're saying, that you have rules that you don't like and you're not used to them because you're used to being independent. And I hadn't thought about that. And again, I asked her, and you know, I asked her a few times in the feature when she says something that I think people would kind of find a little bit contrarian, and she does a good job of explaining where she's at. So that was something that I opened my eyes to. I also think I just felt overall just a lot more comfortable chatting with folks who maybe I wouldn't have spoken with as openly before. I mean, as I discussed earlier, I think something that this feature does really well is humanize a group of people that are so, so often dehumanized across society, right? Like, you see them on the side of the road and a lot of people kind of avert their eyes, turn away, or cross the street to avoid it. And a lot of these folks are just trying to get through the day, much like a lot of other people, obviously with very different challenges. But they have joy in their life. They have challenges. They have struggles. They are, you know, human. They are homeless. That is one part of their identity, but there is a lot more to it as well.
Yeah, not their only identity, clearly, and that's, I think, what you unearth in this is discovering just how many layers there are to these stories. And we think of it as sort of a very zero sum game. You know, if you're unsheltered, then get you shelter, and we're done. And I guess what you found is that is not necessarily the case. I mean, when you walked away from this, would you have? I know this. You know, when you get into, you're not a policymaker, but when you get into sort of how do you try to attempt to fix some of these issues. Did you walk away from this year thinking anything differently than when you walked in?
Yeah, I agree. With the caveat that I'm not a policymaker, I do think that a lot of mental health challenges came up behind the scenes, right? Everyone would kind of talk about this this kind of behind the scenes thing that just they felt like they didn't quite fit in, or people just weren't quite getting it. So I think, you know, you think about going all the way back to getting support kind of right when these folks were telling us that they felt like they were losing those ties to housing, losing those ties to their job. Right. And as soon as a lot of them discussed, okay, so I lost my job or I got laid off and I was kind of in between jobs for a little while. And then from there, they lose their housing. And then they kind of are couch surfing, or they're staying with a friend. And then all of a sudden that goes away. And then they're into their savings. And then they have no savings. And then they're at the food bank. And then from there, they're in the shelter system. And then they don't like the shelter system, or the shelter system, they're you know, somebody gets beat up at the shelter system, or someone steals from them. And then they're in the encampments. And it really is this, like, you know, not death by a thousand cuts, but something like that, right? Kind of chipping away at that leaves them in this very vulnerable position.
Yeah. Morgan, congratulations. It's a great initiative, because I think it really does lay bare something that is too often ignored when we do these. And especially when you get to watch, I mean, there's lots of sort of new long form newspaper stories that are very captivating, but to get to see people live through a year unhoused in Edmonton is not only an incredible challenge to pick up, but also offers a lot of insight into something that we don't spend nearly enough time looking into. Morgan, congratulations. You can find it on YouTube, and I imagine on the Global Edmonton website as well, amongst other places.
Yeah, you bet. It'll be globalnews.ca, the app. It'll be on the streaming services, YouTube, as you mentioned. I think that's it.
Yeah.
And then probably a few other nooks and crannies around the global brand.
Are you going to continue to try and keep in touch with the four of them as we go on?
I'm actually doing, if you have time for me to tell you the story very quickly, I'm actually doing a follow-up story tomorrow on Troy and Leanne, because they went missing for a long, long time during the year. And on Friday, this Friday, I walked out of a different, separate news story, and I bumped into Leanne. And I pulled out my camera and started interviewing her.
Wow.
So that's tomorrow.
Yeah, well... Yeah, we'll look forward to that. Morgan, congratulations. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Doralee.
She wants to say hi. She's with her new boyfriend.
What's he like?
He's nice. Bit of a close talker.
A what?
You'll see.
This is Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
So how long are you folks in town?
Three more days, and then we're off to Paris.
I don't know if you've seen the episode, but it's about close talker. It's Elaine's boyfriend, played by Judge Reinhold, who I remembered best from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, but he literally leans right into people's faces when he's talking to them. Thus, the episode is called The Close Talker. The reason it makes for good comedy is that personal space, or our bubble, is something we all inherently understand. We don't usually conscientiously think about it very much, but we all have sort of a sense of what's comfortable for us. It's kind of a vibe thing, right? But because so much of our communication is nonverbal, when someone steps into what you consider to be your personal space, especially someone you don't know or barely know, it can send a lot of signals. And that became particularly noticeable during the pandemic. Research suggests that personal space standards are changing, and that people around the globe are generally becoming comfortable, less comfortable with strangers, acquaintances, even close friends and family members. So researchers at language learning platform Preply wanted to find out how our personal space varies from country to country and how much it's changed in recent times. Globally, it turns out people have expanded their personal bubbles by an average to an average of about 3 feet, 3 inches, 100 centimeters, meaning communication is more distant than it was just a few years ago. How does Canada rank? Oh, we're kind of near the average. Kind of. And you'd be surprised because we're actually like a little more distance than some of the countries you might think would be more aloof than we are. It turns out we're just a little bit aloof. The country who likes the most space, Romanians, 4.5 feet. I don't know how that came about. The country that likes the least space, Austrians. And they're almost neighbors. I mean, Hungary's in there too on the very distant side. And it's interesting because the Austrians, I mean, they're all neighbors to some extent, not really Austria and Romania, but they're not that far apart. The Colombians and Argentinians are also pretty close at 74 and 76 centimeters. So we thought we'd dig into this one a little bit more with Sylvia Johnson. She's the language and culture expert and head of methodology at Preply. And she joins me now from Barcelona. Sylvia, thank you so much.
Hi, thank you very much for having me again.
It's interesting. I mean, I was reading, of course, one asks, well, why would Preply do this? And then you think, of course, well, you know, it's one thing to learn a language, but a language is almost all nonverbal, right? So one of those things that you should really understand is space, is personal space, because it changes from place to place and from culture to culture.
Yeah, absolutely. So here at Preply, we know that language learning encompasses more than just acquiring a language or mastering vocabulary. It's that entire holistic process that involves both verbal and nonverbal communication. So if you think, well, verbal communication allows our learners to express ideas, ask questions, etc., the nonverbal communication, such as the facial expressions, the gestures, and those proxemic cues, which is really the study we did on personal space, this really helps learners engage in a more appropriate type of communication, and hence why we decided to do this study on personal space.
And it was interesting, the timing of it was interesting because personal space is something we talked about so much at the height of the pandemic and through that period. This was one of the first studies I've seen that would sort of look at what kind of impact it has had, you know, maybe not long term, but certainly in the short to medium term on our whole concept of personal space.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was probably our main learning. I mean, it was unsurprising, as you say, post-pandemic. But what we saw with this study, that across the globe, personal space distance has increased over the last few years. And most cultures are changing how they communicate effectively using that body language and habits. So personal space is a question of, at what point do I feel comfortable having you moving within my space? And it's a little bit about respect, right? That especially you have different types of personal space. So you have the more intimate personal space with your friends, with your loved ones. And then, of course, you go to the personal space at work, which obviously is a little bit further.
It was interesting to see. I mean, you looked at a whole, I think there were 56 countries that ended up on this list. It was interesting to see who wound up where, because it was sometimes it was kind of hard. Like the Austrians had the least personal space, and that seems to have been going on for quite a period of time. And the Romanians had the most, which was also interesting. Canadians, by the way, we kind of finished in the top half of the pack. We like more space, which belied some sort of this notion that we're incredibly friendly. But there's an asterisk beside that, but keep your distance.
I mean, we're also looking at this in times of, as I said before, the post-pandemic, where I think people's natural inclination has been to step further apart. But yes, I mean, that reputation, but still, I mean, the 23rd position, that's not bad out of 56. I mean, and the Canadians did definitely reveal that personal space radius of about 3.5 feet from strangers. So I think it's nothing to be surprised about. And to be fair, amongst all of the countries, the distances were actually fairly minimal.
They were. I mean, we're sort of going from about 75 centimeters to, well, there's a few extremes there. But yeah, Canada, the thing I found interesting was that the Canadians actually, we like more personal space, not by much, mind you, but more than the Americans at 37, the Germans at 36, and Britain at 23.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was very surprised, I think. Again, I'm going to go back to the Austrian point. Like, we found the Austrians the most relaxed with strangers, with a limit of just 71 centimeters before they find uneasy.
Wow.
So I think it really just goes to show you can't tell by nationality. There is a little bit of a culture. Because in general, we did find also that people in warmer countries are more likely to stand closer. We saw that older generations and women would prefer to stand further apart. So yes, I mean, a lot of really, really interesting findings, but I think so important that as you travel, as you work across cultures, to just understand that little bit more of respect, and to make sure that you are aware of it when you're dealing with people from other countries.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things too, when you looked into the changes that happened sort of pre and post pandemic, one of the things that was most interesting was the countries, clearly the countries where people were had the smaller personal spaces all of a sudden had the biggest change once social
Of
distancing and
course.
so on was put into place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that was really important. So if we think the country with the smallest personal space distance before 2020 was Austria, so 71 centimeters before, and the country with the largest personal space was Romania with that 139 centimeters. Yet actually it was Brazil was the country that experienced the largest increase in the average personal space. And surprisingly enough, there was one country on our list that actually had a reduction in that personal space, which was China. So it
Right.
actually had a decrease of 36% in terms of personal space.
Interesting. And you sort of, I guess it's hard to kind of each of these places that there could be all sorts of things going on at once, but it's interesting to see how that would impact. For instance, in a country like Brazil, why would there be such a huge difference between then and now?
Yeah, and I wish I
We
knew the
don't know.
answer, but I'm afraid I can't actually comment on that because we're not entirely sure why. Again, perhaps it is to do with that pandemic. So countries that were previously very small, they decided that they actually need to respect personal space more. They're seeing it more of an idea of if I want to build trust and rapport, especially across the workplace, then I need to respect that. And maybe individuals just being a little bit more aware of that there is a boundary of personal space. And if you go over that boundary, then the person you're talking is less likely to feel that they are in a safe space.
Yeah, I think you pointed out in the
True.
Brazilian case there was a question of trust to some extent as well. I mean, personal space is not you, not just you encroaching on someone else's, but also allowing someone else into yours, right?
Absolutely. And when we think of the benefits of respecting that personal space, you think, so if we respect that personal space, we are creating an environment that fosters positive social interactions. If your personal space is being respected, you're more likely to feel comfortable, a bit more relaxed, a bit more open to engaging with others. So it's also about communication skills as well. So when we're respecting that personal space, we're respecting and reading somebody's non-verbal cues as well. And also this ensures that we communicate a little bit more effectively, we build stronger relationships. So maybe in the case of Brazil, that they have decided being that little bit more self-aware actually encourages them to think a little bit more about how to respect that personal space.
Sylvia Johnson is language and culture expert, head of methodology at Preply, the language learning platform. We're talking about nonverbal communication, always very important, and the whole concept of personal space. If you're going to another country, you may have been abroad and found, wait a second, everyone's either standing very far away from me or everyone's standing very close to me. And it might be just you're not used to having people in your space that way. You may realize if you look around you that everyone is sort of closer together or further apart. And of course, personal space is a big issue. Sylvia, looking at this, what were you hoping that people would walk away from? Because it is interesting to think the next time you're in Austria, you might want to take a step in, and next time you're in Romania, you may want to take a step back.
Yeah, I think what we wanted to do with this survey was just to create awareness of the need to respect the personal space and it's important in effective communication. So we wanted to help people understand also that, for example, because Preply is obviously based on language learning, we're connecting our tutors and students. So you're mastering all sorts of linguistic skills, but we also wanted to emphasize the importance of mastering the intercultural skills and the nonverbal communication in general. So just sort of one thing I'd like to leave you with here as well is that when we think, you said before that everyone has expanded their personal bubbles, but everyone has expanded those bubbles by an average of 100 centimeters, like 3 foot 3 inches.
Yeah.
So communication is a lot more distance than it was a few years ago. And if you can respect that, and if in doubt, take a step backwards.
Yeah, indeed. What I liked about it is that it sort of not that it defied certain stereotypes, but for instance, I was interested to see that Canadians like more distance from their closest family and friends than the Brits do. I mean, it was actually that we like a step back compared to other. But there were certain things about stereotypes, and then what this found that defied of some of those stereotypes.
Oh, completely. So, I mean, UK residents, I'm British myself, we're typically known for our social aloofness, like don't come too close, etc. But actually, yeah, we to a certain extent that we find that personal space and attitudes towards those personal space have really changed. And some of the countries that you would expect to find on the other end of the spectrum were a little bit closer.
Yeah. The Americans was an interesting one, too, because obviously as Canadians and Americans, we always compare ourselves. We really do think of the Americans needing less personal space. They're closer talkers and so on. It turns out that is true to a certain extent, but not by much.
Exactly. And were you, I mean, what would you say you were particularly surprised by in this study? Was that kind of one of your main takeaways?
Well, it was
you would expect to see at the bottom came at the top.
It was more just how close everything was. I mean, how really we're talking, it's just a matter of centimeters. But yeah, there was a few interesting ones. I mean, no, I don't think people would think of the Americans and the Germans as liking the same amount of personal space. And yet, you know, that's what it found. Or the Italians being right there. I mean, you sort of think of those things being different from country to country, but that may be a misread of the verbal communication. They all communicate verbally, non-verbally differently, but maybe they're not that far apart.
Sure, no, absolutely. And as you said, sort of the top and the bottom both being European countries, Romania being the biggest space and Austria being the smallest space, you would expect neighbouring countries or countries in the same continent to be much more similar. But no, there were some prizes. And the UK, again, 20, I think it was
99 centimetres. Yeah,
23rd. Yeah, so what I found after we did this survey as well, I was much more conscious of how far I was standing away with everybody, either in the office. And then I realized that all of this was smashed to smithereens the moment you get on a commuter train.
Well, of course.
There was absolutely no respect for personal space.
No. It's nice that Spain and Britain were just 1 centimeter apart. So you didn't really have that much.
Absolutely. Felt very comfortable there.
That much learning to do. Yeah. I suppose you could actually ask people in your office situation where they're from and then sort of figure out, take out the measuring tape and figure out what that means for you, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think what would be interesting if we were to run this survey in 5 years, how much it would have actually changed and whether we would see that people were getting more comfortable post-pandemic of reducing that personal space once more. And again, we saw, as I said, I think people in warmer countries are more likely to stand closer. That sometimes goes a little bit against the grain. We think the warmer it is, actually, you probably want to give each other a little bit of distance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's fascinating what we'll find now and what we're going to find in 5 years'
right.
time.
But a really interesting reminder of just how important nonverbal communication is. So you can actually get off on the wrong foot, pun intended, if you're way into someone's personal space. I mean, it's good to know.
Well, absolutely. I mean, when we think about nonverbal communication, so whether you're aware of it or not, when you interact with others, you're continuously giving and receiving those wordless signals. So all of your nonverbal behaviors, the gestures, your posture, so even sort of postures in online meetings, postures in physical meetings, your tone of voice, the kind of eye contact you make, all of these deliver really, really strong messages. And when we actually look and we interpret and we pay attention to these signs, it's quite often the nonverbal communication that puts people at ease, that it builds trust, and also draws people towards you. So just remember, even when you're silent, you're probably communicating nonverbally. And what I find really interesting about verbal and nonverbal communication is when you're faced with mixed signals, the listener has to choose whether to believe your verbal or your nonverbal message. They're going to choose your nonverbal message.
Yeah.
That's what they put the trust in. So absolutely, I think if you can ensure that you're respecting personal space and you're aware of all your nonverbal communication, you're going to be able to really foster that trust and build relationships.
Yeah, action speaks louder than words. Sylvia, as always, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Chocolate is what we're going to talk about this half hour. Easter is coming up at the end of the month. It's a bit early this year. And of course, that's always the time of year that I most associate with chocolate, because it's probably the only time of year where I actually buy and consume chocolate without shame or without thinking about it, better yet. But if you've noticed perhaps in the past little while, the price of cocoa futures, they trade as a commodity, right? Is just it's doubled in 2024. So are we facing a future with slimmer, smaller chocolate bars and smaller Easter candy and so on coming up in the next little while? The good news is that a lot of people will have made their purchases a bit early. So maybe what's happened in 2024 won't have a massive impact just yet. And that's not universally true. That might be true for the big chocolate makers, maybe not so much for the smaller ones. Executives from Hershey and Cadbury have already pointed to additional price hikes in recent earning calls, and the rising cocoa cost is the main culprit behind those increases. So what's happening with cocoa? If you didn't know, and I wasn't really very aware of this, almost all of the cocoa, or two-thirds of it, on the planet is grown in two countries, Ghana and the Ivory Coast, or Côte d'Ivoire in West Africa. That's it. In fact, the cocoa belt in West Africa is responsible for much of the cocoa that we buy. Now, it's traded as a commodity, so these are contracts that lock in prices for a future date. But those futures have doubled in 2024 so far, and it's only March 18th, up to an astounding $8,500 US a metric ton. That's huge, double what it was last year. Analysts blame weather issues and crop diseases that have slashed yields in the cocoa belt in West Africa, which, as I was mentioning, produces the majority of the world's cocoa beans. Not only are they predicting less supply, a decline of almost 11%, demand also is still up 5% this year. So do the math, and Ousma Sharif, a chocolatier, can kind of explain to you what's going on.
We ended up stocking up 6 months to 8 months, as much as we could get from our vendors at the same price. And then after 6-8 months, when our stock is depleted, we're going to have to raise prices.
There you have it. So basically, because of the way it's sold, there is a sort of a small window of reprieve here for a lot of chocolate makers. But as we head into Easter and then into the summer and so on, the expectation is chocolate's going to get more expensive. Sofia Caro Denuto is an assistant professor of geography at the University of Victoria who specializes in West African cocoa production. So she knows of what she speaks, and she joins me now. Sofia, thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
I guess for listeners to understand how this works, because I don't know whether we often think about what it is that we're consuming, whether it be coffee or cocoa or any of those commodity crops, but tell me a bit about just how important certain countries are to the world cocoa market.
Yes, thank you. So about 60% of the world's cocoa comes from two small countries in West Africa. And the highest producer, Côte d'Ivoire, or sometimes called Ivory Coast, produces about 40% of the world's cocoa. Ghana is second, comes in at about 20%. And so these two countries have really focused a lot of their rural economy around the production of this commodity crop. It's all exported.
Wow. That's a huge number. I don't think people understand that 60% of the world's cocoa comes from two little countries. I mean, it's far more dominant than even something like oil, right? That's an incredible number.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, that also maybe symbolizes the potential resilience issues with the supply chain, that if we experience drought or a prevalence of disease in one of these two countries, the whole world supply of cocoa is at risk.
And I gather, I mean, perhaps explain, I mean, what we've seen in the last little while is an absolute surge in the price of the commodity itself.
Yeah, so this is unprecedented. I don't know how many of your listeners have seen the charts, but the price of cocoa has gone, it's hit $7,000 per ton. It's gone above historical records. But at the same time, this is a typical commodity boom and bust cycle. If you go back a few decades, you see that the price of cocoa on the world market has always followed a cycle of boom and bust, goes up and down. It's just that what we're seeing right now in terms of boom has been unprecedented. But it's likely just a matter of time before that crashes.
Before it comes back down. In the meantime, though, what is going on the ground in Côte d'Ivoire and Ghana right now to justify what we're seeing in the market?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of commodity experts and cocoa and chocolate connoisseurs are trying to make sense of what's happening and attribute that boom. What we do know is that Côte d'Ivoire, the number one producer of cocoa, has had a 30% drop in production this year, mainly due to erratic weather patterns, but also prevalence of disease. So, you know, with a country that's responsible for 40% of the world's supply of cocoa, a 30% drop is quite significant. At the same time, there's speculation right? So there's something to be said about the role of commodity traders in potentially, making trade or speculating in a way
Speculating
that,
up the price, right, of course.
yes. So it's unclear how much of that price increase reflects actual deficit in terms of not meeting demand.
Right. It's interesting also how you pointed out how exactly it is grown. You mentioned it, I think you alluded to it earlier, that a lot of it's, in Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire particularly, a lot of rural areas are sort of devoted to the production of cocoa. But these are small farms. I mean, this is not massive industrial farms producing this stuff. And that in itself comes with its own complexities.
Yeah. So the way cocoa is grown, it's a very sensitive tropical tree that is basically a fruit. So when you eat chocolate, you're eating the seeds. The cocoa beans are the seeds of a tropical fruit. They're quite big seeds, but they're harvested in a way that requires a significant amount of manual labor. So these fruits ripen at different times, and the trees also require pruning and regular maintenance in order to continue to be productive. There's also an increasing prevalence of disease. Like I said, it's a very sensitive crop, so it's pesticides, herbicides are very often used, but simple pruning techniques are very important for maintaining the optimum shade conditions on the farm to avoid the prevalence of disease. It's very difficult to mechanize cocoa production and scale it up in a way that, would reflect a plantation of different types of crops. So it's really dependent on smallholder farming models, and there's millions of smallholders, especially in the West African cocoa belt. It's not only Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, also Nigeria, Cameroon produce a lot of cocoa, not nearly as much, but there's that whole area in Africa, West and Central Africa, where cocoa is grown. And so we have estimates of, anywhere from 2 to 5 million cocoa farmers. No one knows precisely. It's
Yeah.
the
You're saying that one of the problems with this, though, is that when something happens, when disaster strikes, like disease or drought or so on, that it's very hard to get the right kinds of subsidies and help to those individual farmers to make sure that they can weather the storm and make their crop more or make their operation more resilient.
Yeah, so I would say a major challenge is the lack of investment over the years, and that we're seeing that farms are becoming older, trees are becoming older, some are 60 to 70 year old trees that need to be regenerated, rejuvenated, and replanted, really. So it requires a lot of investment. It also requires farmers to forego the profits of being able to sell cocoa beans for a few years while the new trees grow.
No, I would imagine that's part of the problem. They don't have the, when the price spikes like this, it doesn't end up back in the farmer's hands, so they can sort of use it to rebuild.
Yeah, and that's a major issue. I mean, at the same time, it's not surprising. What we're seeing in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire is that it's a highly regulated market. So the governments of Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana play a huge role in regulating the sector, dictating the price that farmers receive. So the producer price is what it's called. That's what farmers receive for their product, the farm gate price. And this is set at the beginning of the season. And based on those predictions, or based on those minimum prices set by the government, the sale of cocoa is done via forward contracts. So any multinational buyer from the chocolate industry, any multinational buyer of cocoa beans will have forward contracts where the price is set in advance of the harvest. That's why we're not seeing farmers in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire actually receiving a higher price, despite the world market's just going crazy right now.
Sophia Caro Denuto is with us this half hour, an assistant professor of geography at the University of Victoria. She specializes in West African cocoa production. In fact, West African cocoa production is most of the cocoa production on this planet, 60% in two countries alone, Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana. We're talking about this because the price of cocoa has jumped to $7,500 US a metric ton, which is up 75% since the beginning of the year. It's the highest it's ever been. It's a huge jump, and we're going to see it impact chocolate prices eventually, if not just yet. There is always a little bit of a lag. Sophia, when looks ahead to this, with the impacts of climate change, with the way the whole system is structured, with all these smallholding farmers in Ghana and in Côte d'Ivoire, you get the sense that it's not a very resilient setup for a product that is so universally popular and in demand.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana is this is bulk commodity cocoa. This is the cocoa that goes into your Nutella and your Cocoa Puffs, the products that have no indication of origin.
Right.
So if you can't decipher where the cocoa comes from in the products that you're eating, it's very likely coming from one or both of those countries. Now, we're seeing a growth in so-called specialty or fine chocolate, which really focuses on origin, single origin products, mostly in chocolate bars, but you'll probably see that increasingly in gelato or hot chocolate, different products
Right,
that
sort of
integrate
specialty
cocoa.
stuff, right? We're sort of
Yeah.
thinking industrial grade cocoa here is what we're talking about to some extent.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there, what consumers might be interested in looking for, and what I would argue is even more important than a fair trade or organic label, is the origin. If a retailer or a producer of different cocoa or chocolate products can be 100% knowledgeable about where their cocoa beans come from, that gives me the confidence that that is a better product.
Right. I guess though a lot of what we consider to be chocolate, sort of the, as you mentioned, the Nutellas and the Cocoa Puffs and the sort of industrial grade chocolate bars rely on this cocoa, right? And it feels, I'm just wondering how resilient it is given all that we're seeing on the ground. Obviously, it's a huge industry for those two countries, but how resilient is it given the impacts of climate change and drought and so on?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think that there's a lot of effort going on right now from the government. There are extension services for agriculture from the government. There's also the major companies buying and trading cocoa that are investing in farms, not at the rate we need, but it's happening. There's also cocoa expansion or production, farming of cocoa expanding in many other countries around the world. We're seeing Cameroon growing in how much it's exporting. So I think that we don't have to worry quite yet, but thinking about where we're putting our money in terms of investing in the resilience of these cocoa farms moving forward, I think it's important to start thinking about that. But yeah, it'll be an interesting thing to watch in the coming years. How fast does this start to affect the pocketbooks of Canadian consumers?
Right. Do you get the sense that this spike that we've seen is going to be a bit of a wake-up call as to exactly what that, I mean, we've seen it happen with other commodities, coffee in particular. Is this going to be a bit of a wake-up call to what the future could look like if we're looking at $7,500 a metric ton?
I hope so, because the price that farmers are receiving right now is not enough for a living wage.
So in other words, we're paying too little for it.
We are paying too little for it. There's been
Interesting.
numerous studies that show that even with the fair trade premium, even with the price differential of fair trade, farmers in West Africa are still below a living income. So there's
Wow.
a lot of progress that needs to be made, especially for the most vulnerable segments of the supply chain, the smallholder farmers.
Right.
They're the ones that have the least voice and the least power in this supply chain, and they're the ones that are really not benefiting at all from this massive boom in the commodity price.
Right. Presumably, commodity traders and perhaps the governments of Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana might be benefiting from it, though, since they've set the prices.
You didn't hear that from me, but you can assume.
Sounds logical. Well, Sophia, thank you so much for shedding some light. I don't think a lot of people actually know where the chocolate they eat most of it comes from, and this has been fascinating. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Ben. Great to talk with you.
Point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit.
That movie's nearly 40 years old, but that quote from Michael Douglas's character Gordon Gekko in Oliver Stone's Wall Street seems to capture the ethos that most people believe drove and still drives high finance, especially Wall Street. My next guest spent 2 years right in the middle of it, working as the personal assistant to the billionaire founder of one of America's most secretive and prestigious Wall Street hedge funds. Carrie Sun's debut book is called Private Equity, a Memoir, and it charts her story from growing up in Michigan, the only child of parents who immigrated from China when she was very young, to landing a big job at Fidelity after graduating from MIT, making big money, to deciding that's not what she wanted to do. What she wanted to do was write. But to go to school, to go back to school, she needed to find a job that was somewhat less demanding on her time than what she'd been doing before. And so up comes the opportunity to be the right hand to one of Wall Street's biggest success stories. So she decides to go for it. 14 interviews, many, many reference checks, and many more hoops later, she gets the gig. Her new boss, described under the pseudonym Boone Prescott, and the firm name is also fictional, called Carbon, but this is a true story, is described as a nice billionaire, quote, not a Gordon Gekko type at all. What unfolds after that, though, is anything but. Not only the demands on her time that become ever increasing, weekends, et cetera, et cetera. There's a moment in the memoir when she answers a text while running on the treadmill that doesn't end well. Listen, there are rewards here, plenty, big salary, big bonus perks, but the downside is just as steep. And that's what she explores in this book, is the whole idea of that culture. What is it like? What is it like to be in it? What are the people who run it like? And it's a personal journey through all of this as well, as to what is the cost benefit of having a job like that. Carrie Sun, her first book is called Private Equity, a Memoir, and she joins me now. Carrie, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to be here today.
Well, congratulations on the first book. And what have you made of the reaction to it? Because a lot of people are talking about it. I think it's obvious a lot of people love to look behind the curtains of these places, especially with someone who's stood in those rooms for a long time.
The reaction I'm finding is so interesting, because I certainly have been hearing from, I think, a broad demographic. I have men writing into me who've said they'd cry for my book. That was a little surprising. But really, people who are, people who work on Wall Street have been loving it. And people who are kind of on a different end of the political spectrum as well. So I'm happy I'm able to speak to all these readers across different demographics, worldviews, ideologies, and because I think my book is hopefully tapping into something about the nature of work itself and how that concept of work might not be working for a lot of people.
Yeah, that was the interesting part of it, because I think a lot of people want to sort of see what it's like to work in that environment, because so oftentimes, especially for certain financial institutions, we just don't ever hear much about them. And that was sort of a modus operandi at the one you were working at. I was sort of like, no quotes, no story, right?
Yeah, no quotes, no story, nothing public ever. So there's just this black hole of information. And I also think, where there is kind of this absence, people might make up their own stories about what happens. And sometimes, I'm not a spokesperson for anyone except myself. So certainly not about the firm or my former boss, but really, I in this book wanted to document my own experiences of working there, which were in some ways fantastic, just in that it was a wonderful learning experience. Everyone there was super smart, worked super hard, but there's also kind of a very unglamorous, kind of really upsetting, dark, tragic side to that work, even though, on the surface, things were seamless, frictionless, just you had every resource in the world. But if you peel all of that away, I think at the end of the day, what I'm getting at is a just fundamentally huge gap, power gap between the owners and the workers. And I just don't even know how to bridge that gap at all, because, my boss compensated me well. He even praised me at times. But at the end of the day, when I tried to speak up for what I wanted, which was simply more resources to help me do my job, it was a big fight. I'll just say that.
Yeah, there's this. I should, for listeners to understand how you arrived at this position, because you didn't arrive, and I don't know how people would think one would arrive as the right hand to a billionaire hedge fund owner. But you arrived in a very circuitous kind of way through, you know, through Fidelity, through a bunch of really big jobs, made very, very good money, fell in love with writing, decided you wanted to do something different, and then wound up here. Your interview process was, I think, a head scratcher for anyone who's never been through it. It felt like you were sort of applying to you know, I don't know what the equivalent would be, but to join some sort of secret order or something.
Yes. And I felt like they were not only, it wasn't just, 14 interviews. And if those 14 people all checked the box and liked me, that in itself is a tall order. But also, I think it was a pure test of endurance and stamina and how all in you could be. Because at the end of these 14 interviews, the kind of the last step was 10 reference checks. And they were not like, give me 10 names. No, they picked the names and told me they wanted to talk to these people. So I had to reach out to people in my network, to whom I hadn't spoken in many, many years, and just be like, can you offer up your time to speak to this random, not random, but just this firm that I want to get a job at? So in a sense, that was such a great analogy for just my job, which is make the impossible happen and ask other people to change their days, spend their time helping this firm accomplish its own goals.
Carrie Sun is with us this half hour. Her book is called Private Equity, a memoir. You've probably seen it on lists around. It's been very well received. Carrie, it was interesting just reading your experience with this organization, because it does feel in some ways almost cult-like. And I think that's always been the complaint from people who work outside of these industries, is that the compensation, of course, is, I think a lot of people would find it enviable to be paid that much, because lots of people work lots of hours who wish they didn't have to, right? But the compensation is enviable. But it's sort of the, what always interests me and what interests me about your book is just how it's all wrapped up in this veneer of kind of altruism and family and all these words. You think, well, wait a second, there's no way the place is a family, right?
Yes. I'm so happy you picked up that family aspect as well. And it can also be said a slight cultish aspect, by which I just mean that to be part of the in-group, I will just say institutions largely here, but there is something so seductive and alluring to be on the inside of an institution like this, to be in on the inside of a cult, to feel that belonging and to be a part of this, I will say, a warm embrace. It's like a warm hug of the family. And the
And a
problem
lucrative
aspect,
one. I mean, this is about your
exactly.
survival too, right? It's about your survival as well. You need to make a living, all those things.
It is. And that is ultimately why I first ended up taking the job, is because I had been burning through my savings, trying to, figure out my life. I was 29 at the time, didn't know what I wanted to do. I needed to earn a living because I strongly believe in being independent. I didn't want to rely on anyone else. So I took this job. But to get back to kind of that family aspect, it's once you're on the inside, there is a, if you raise your hand at all or, push back at all, I will say just voice pushback or be disobedient in any way, there's a high cost to that, because you might be immediately kicked out of the group, seen as not being a part of the family. You might be immediately shunned, and you have a label placed on you as being not tough enough, not being able to cut it. And just that fear of being exiled, as it were, like it is just really, really strong in especially a small group, the firm I was at is in no way small, but they were very lean for the in terms of employees, for the amount of money they were managing, just AUM.
Yeah, and it must. I mean, I think it, and you mentioned this in the book too. I don't know how it wreaks havoc with your other relationships, but when you become very much part of something small and quite exclusive, it starts to impact your other relationships too, because other people just either won't see it or don't like it, or they, it does have an impact right across your friendship and family group.
Absolutely. And so, even when my closest friends were noticing my both behavior change and things that I used to enjoy, like writing, playing piano, I was doing, not only was I not doing any of it, when my friends would call me out on it, sort of, like, remind me, you used to love doing this. Like, why aren't you doing this? I would actually double down on defending my work and say, well, I have to work. Like this is what's required. Like, and it just, I really felt that I was, in a sense, my therapist uses this term actually, brainwashed to believe in many of the values of the work culture that I found myself in. And what to me is troubling is that, especially in the beginning, it's just to me that, I mean, maybe to other people the red flags will be more obvious, but to me they weren't obvious at all. It was kind of a slow build over time of realizing that what I had signed up for turned out to not actually be the reality, and it was not actually the case. And so it was something that took me ultimately several years to really come to terms with.
Yeah. And in the book, I should mention that Carrie does go through, sort of growing up as an only child. Her parents had sort of survived the Cultural Revolution in China. There was sort of a dynamic going on too, that you do go into a lot to try and explore why it is that some of what happened. Tell me about your decision to walk away, because that was the big one, right? And it ultimately, that's how this book comes together, is that you decide, I'm done.
Yes. I Up until really, I would say things happened so fast. From the time I really thought that I might leave to leaving, I felt like that I made the decision in an instant. Basically, what happened was I spoke to my boss about being really burnt out. I was so not just burnt out, it was severe burnout. I was having physical issues, mental issues, like mental health. Probably qu being quite depressed and anxious, and all the effects of severe burnout. And I spoke to him about it, and I think he sort of didn't really believe me or didn't really take me seriously, and kind of punted the issue. But it was really that, to me, was a moment of clarity, because when there are other emergencies, he would make decisions involving many millions of dollars in investments in an instant, and certainly within a day. And yet I came to him with an emergency, and he just thought it could wait. It couldn't wait. But in our conversation, he told me to get a therapist to help. He thought he punted the problem back to me. He thought that I could, seek professional help in trying to deal with my stress better. So I did see a therapist, and my therapist, instead of helping me do my job better, she helped me realize that I wanted to leave my job. And I it was two therapy sessions, and I realized this. And then the next business day, I walked into my boss's office and quit.
Yes, it's a, yeah, and I'll let people get into that part of the book, because it's an interesting part as well. But you, what was it like to then just to sit down and write it all down? Because ultimately, part of all this was you wanted to write, and needless to say, now you had this incredible, you did have this story to tell, which is, I was going to say it's ironic, but it's not. It's a bit, it's tough, but there was your story.
You know what's incredible is the mind kind of hides it. The mind is just brilliant at hiding things from you. So when, I quit my job in 2016. It ends in 2016, and obviously, right now it's 2024. It's been
Yes.
8 years. It wasn't like I quit this job and I knew this was a fantastic story and I wanted to write about it. In fact, I took my time, because I really do care to develop my craft. I hope to have many books in me, and I started my MFA. And even during my MFA, it was not clear that I wanted to write about this experience. I knew I had survived something really intense, and I didn't know what had happened to me in those 2 years. In fact, my burnout was so severe. I was telling myself that I still couldn't look at it head on yet. And it was only through writing many different essays, like during my MFA, some people mentioned, like, I think you're writing around the thing you really want to write about. And what I really wanted to write about was to kind of understand exactly what had happened to me, and what does that mean for, I think I took a look around. Everyone I knew was burnt out. Everyone I knew during my MFA was working multiple jobs just to pay their tuition and also live in New York. Everybody was working in order to support some dream of theirs, and being burnt out in the process and having really precarious health care. And just, I thought, I saw everyone struggling with work and I knew I had something to say. I didn't know what yet, but I knew it probably would come from the two most intense years of my life, which I document in this book.
Yeah. I guess the obvious final question is, did Boone read, has Boone read it, so to speak?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but as you know, I write in the book. I told him from day one that I wanted to be a writer, and he thought I was going to write in my free time, after my hedge fund job. That didn't happen. But he's a really, really busy guy. He still runs a huge firm, and so I don't know if he's read it, but I hope if he has or will someday, that the highest respect I can give any character is to really treat them as human. I don't know if he will agree with me, but like I really, for everyone I write about in the book, including my parents and other people, there have been difficult times, but I can only write about someone, anyone for whom I actually have some sort of affection for. And I do feel that way about him and the firm. I hope them success, all the success in the world. And I hope that even bosses who read this book will question their own relationship to work.
Oh, indeed. Carrie, thank you.
Thank you so much for your time today, Ben.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think French fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.